Hello, listeners. Welcome to Western Section Podcast, podcast for wildlifers. I am your host, workshop manager Ivan Parr, and I'm here with my co-host, student affairs co-chair, and North Coast chapter rep Lizzie Meisman. Hello, Lizzie.
Hey, everybody.
How's it going?
Happy to be here.
Great. For our Get to Know the Board series, we are interviewing members of the Western Section Board, and today we have two very special guests, the president and president-elect, Kelly Holland and Dan Irola.
Listeners, before we got to questions, Lizzie asked Dan about his heritage, and Dan and Kelly both shared a little bit about their backstories. Dan, as you'll ascertain, is one of the world experts on tricolored blackbird.
Well, I'm pretty watered down, but even though it doesn't sound that much like it, we came from Italy, in northern Italy, you know, to work in the mines in the 1860s in Calaveras County in the foothills. Wow. And so then my family's been in ranching up there pretty much ever since. Wow. Although my father, now I'm getting in detail, but my father contracted polio, speaking of pandemics, when he was 11. And so he, you know, was partially disabled and unable to be a rancher. So he ended up becoming an attorney in San Francisco. And I grew up in the Bay Area, but traveled back and forth to Calaveras County seemingly every other weekend for my life, and spent a lot of time, you know, on the ranch, looking at the feed. How's the feed doing? That was the one topic of conversation, you know, the forage for the cattle, and looking at cattle and hunting and fishing and all those things. So that was my history. That was a long answer to a simple question.
I'm glad I asked, though, because
yeah,
that's fantastic.
Too. So interesting.
So growing up on the ranch, is that where you met your first tricolored blackbird?
No, I it's possible that they were there, but I didn't know enough to know, because most people, you know, can't separate or recognize a tricolored blackbird as separate from a red-winged blackbird. But no, actually, my first encounter was because my office mate, Ted Beatty, really was the state expert on tricolored blackbirds. And he took me out to a couple of sites that he was studying at the time. And I was doing other things. But I remember the first site I went to was in Folsom. And that site was destroyed to make the Folsom Lake College. And then another sort of interesting visit, we went to Calusa National Wildlife Refuge, or maybe Sacramento, and seeing the colony of 50,000 tricolors nesting together there. And we went up the next week to look at them, and there were zero. They were gone. There had been a black-crowned night heron colony nearby that found the colony and attacked it, and the whole colony dissipated, which
wow.
is a relatively common with tricolored blackbirds, that, you know, you get 10,000 and then you go back 3 days later and they picked up and moved because there wasn't enough food. So, and it's a natural thing too. I mean, it's not always a result of disturbance or anything like that there. But anyway, that's getting into the whole tricolor thing, which is interesting for its own sake, but we probably don't have time for it anyway.
Kelly, how long has your family been in this country, or what's the Kelly?
What's my story? So I'm Irish and Norwegian, but it was my great-grandparents who came here. So the Irish side came over during the famine, and the Norwegians came because there was a whole bunch of great rangeland in Montana. And so my family's ended up in California because of World War II. My mom's dad was a physicist and was recruited by the Navy. So that's how we ended up in Ridgecrest, China Lake. Her family did in the 40s. And my dad's family had been in Kansas, and World War II changed the structure of and viability of my grandpa's little corner grocery store. And so he gave that up and moved out to Oakland to work in the shipyards and brought his family out there like 6 months later. My poor grandmother brought five children out on the train by herself. And then my dad, he also was a physicist. And once he graduated college, he was recruited by the Navy and ended up in Ridgecrest, China Lake. So that's that's my family migration.
So, Lizzie, do you have the three standard questions for our guests?
I'm at the ready. Who are we firing at first?
Let's do Kelly, then Dan.
Perfect. Kelly, what is your favorite animal?
My favorite animal is the jaguar. I had the incredible opportunity to be a Peace Corps volunteer in the rainforest of South America for 2.5 years. And I got to see six of them in the wild, and it was pretty amazing. That animal is forever my favorite. It touched me deeply, and I feel so incredibly honored to have seen it so many times in the wild.
That is amazing.
It was a little terrifying every single time, but I'm happy to be here to report that I'm safe.
Did you have a close encounter?
Yes, all times. I'll tell you about my first time I saw a jaguar. I was out doing field surveys on my own. And where I was working, we didn't have radios. So my safety measure was to tell the park staff where I was going, and they knew to kind of check, and I would check in with them when I got back. And if it was too late, they would, if it was around dinner time, they would check my cabin, and then they would go out looking, which never happened, but that was our protocol. So I was out doing my field survey, and all week long, park visitors had been reported that they had seen a top ear out in this one section of the park where I was going to go survey. And I was so excited. I'd never seen a top ear before. I'm like, this is my day. I'm going to see a top ear. So I walked out to the end. It was about, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles out. And on my return, there was this large animal laying in the road. And so you have to understand, I'm walking on this ridgeline. There is really just one pathway between where I've been and where I need to get to. And this animal is laying right in the middle of it. And I was so excited. I'm like, this is my top ear. I'm so excited. And being the good field biologist I am, I pulled out my field notebook and I'm writing down the date and the time and the weather and the location. And I'm like, oh, this is the top ear. And then the animal stood up and started to stretch. And I'm like, wow, that doesn't make sense. That top ear has spots. Like, my mind's not computing this. This doesn't make sense. And then that animal moved out of the shade into the sun. I'm like, oh, well, that's a jaguar. Oh, okay. And I'm still being a very good biologist. I'm writing down my notes and about this jaguar, and it's a male, and da da da. And about this size. And I look down and I notice that my hand is shaking as I'm writing. And I'm like, okay, Kelly, you're really freaked out. It's time to put your notebook away and, you know, get yourself out of here in a really safe way. And so what I did was he was looking at me and I was looking at him. We're probably 150 yards away. And I just start backing myself back down the road. Where there was kind of a little outlook camp where I stopped. And I just backed myself down that road for about a half mile and got there. And all I could do was like, Kelly, you got to get all the fear out of you. You just got to shake it out. You cannot walk down that road again feeling this fear, because it'll smell it on you. And so I just shook it out. And then I walked back down the road maybe an hour later, just singing Jingle Bells at the top of my lungs. Just like, I'm coming through. I'm coming through. Wishing you peace. And I remember the jaguar was gone off the road by the time I got to that spot, but I could smell it. They have a very strong musky scent. And And at one point along the trail, every hair in my body stood up. I'm like, oh, it's still here. But it was fine. It was amazing.
Oh, that sounds so exciting.
Yeah. That was my favorite encounter.
I can certainly see why. Though a little scary too.
They're big. They're very big.
So Dan, do you have a favorite animal?
Well, I really should have gone first because it's kind of hard to top that story. I guess I have to say my favorite animal is the one I spent the most time studying. So it's a purple martin, you know, which is a bird. And my kind of history with that bird is that I'm answering the next question, I think. I worked on the Lassen National Forest for my first job. And up there were historical records of purple martins nesting. And I looked and I looked and I looked for over 5 years that I spent time out covering 1 million acres of California on the Almanor Ranger and adjacent lands on the Lassen. Never found one. And then I moved to Sacramento. And one day, a couple of years after I got here, I was driving north on Highway 5 in the middle of downtown Sacramento, and the first purple martin I ever saw swooped right across the front of my windshield. And, you know, I was just so stunned, like, what the hell? Oh, whoops, sorry. And, you know, it just sort of hooked me in. Well, what is going on here? How could the bird not be where it's supposed to be? And it's here in the middle of the city. That was probably about 1990, and I started studying purple martins that were living in the freeways in Sacramento in about 1991, took a break during the late 90s, and I've been at it working on this species since continuously as they're here since 2002. So I've put literally thousands of hours trying to understand why are they here? What are they doing? Why are they declining? Because they're declining. They've declined. The population here has declined by about 85% over the last 15 years. And also trying to protect them from all the terrible things that people do, disrupting the habitat, disrupting the nesting. And I spent more time with it. It must be my favorite. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it.
So it seems like you have a connection with this bird from a conservation level, from a biological level, and even a personal level.
Yeah, I really do. You know, it's such an unusual species and an unusual situation in which to have a species that really should be listed. It deserves to be state listed, I believe. And here it is living in a freeway. And as a result, nobody knows, when I started, no one really knew practically anything about it. Biologists don't hang around, you know, these disagreeable places underneath freeways like I do. And so very few people really understood what's going on or understood how we could protect this species. And so that's been one of my missions over many years. I found, especially when you do color banding, you get to know individual birds, you know, oh, there's, you know, A42. Oh, A42. He bred with, you know, A67 last year at Sutterville. And now he's over here at I Street. Anyway, it does become personal.
Oh, that's a great favorite species and a great justification for it, too, I think.
Well, moving on with the second question. I'd be interested to hear what the best advice either of you, both of you, has ever received. Kelly, do you want to start?
Sure. I mean, actually, the best advice in my career I ever received was way back in high school from my high school biology teacher. I was probably a junior, and sophomore or junior, and he took the time to ask me one day. He said, Kelly, what are you interested in studying in college? And I'm like, I don't know. I want to be an architect. I thought I wanted to be an architect from the time I was sixth grade onward. And that's what I was set on. And he paused and he listened about my why. And he said, you know, have you thought about how good you are at science? Like, you've taken all my science classes, you know, botany, biology, zoology. You are a firestorm when you come to these classes. Have you thought about going into a field of science like that. I'm like, no, I want to be an architect. He's like, so do you know you have to be really good at math? I was like, no one told me that. Oh no. And he really kind of just shifted my path profoundly and got me into this path where I am now. And he's someone I stay in touch with to this day. And I've told him many, many times, I'm so thankful for that conversation. No one else was having that conversation with me at that time. And I'm so grateful that I had a high school teacher who took interest in my career. And obviously he was a little biased, you know, he had a passion for environmental studies and environmental science and natural history. And so he definitely inspired me and set me on my way. So,
well, we are grateful for him as well, because here you are, our president.
Go high school biology teachers.
What high school was that again?
Oh, I grew up in a rural town in Ridgecrest, California. So Burroughs High School. And Mr. Morgan is his name. He's fabulous.
Shout out to Mr. Morgan.
Thank you for that, Kelly. That's wonderful when people see the potential in us, especially as young people. And Dan, would you tell us about what the best advice you've heard?
I sort of have two things. You know, one is, and I don't really remember who told me this, but it is that integrity matters above all else. And, you know, I worked in the Forest Service for years at a time when we were cutting large amounts of timber. I worked in consulting, where there's oftentimes pressures on you to come to certain conclusions. And, you know, the idea of integrity is very important in all of our work, because, you know, it's hard to live with yourself if you don't have integrity. And so that's always been something that I've held close. And a second thing is hear people out, that I learned you really have to give people time to express their views and to listen to them carefully and consider them, even if you don't agree or you don't take their advice. I had my first boss at the Forest Service was a guy, gruff old guy by the name of Bill Swanson at the Almanor Ranger District at Lake Almanor. And, you know, he probably decided against my recommendations as a brand new biologist, all idealistic and, you know, wanting to save the world. He decided against my recommendations about 80% of the time, but he always gave me the opportunity to make my case and always explained to me why he wasn't going to accept my recommendations. And that really impressed me. You know, I respected him. I still think he's probably the best boss I ever had. Again, even though he almost never agreed with me. So,
yeah, that's so valuable. And you've already hinted at it a bit, but our next question is, what was your first job? We can start with Kelly, and then when we circle back to you, Dan, you can definitely elaborate on, I feel like we only got a snippet of what you were doing. But yeah, Kelly, would you tell us more about your first job?
I'll give two answers. I mean, one was my first job and one was probably the first job I had in my wildlife biologist field. But my first job was in high school as a board engineer for the local radio station. It was pretty epic. I played all the commercials and had to keep them on track and had to manage some very conservative talk show radio station and some very hip country radio station at the same time. That's where I worked on the weekends. It was nothing to write home about, but it's a very interesting first job. My first paying wildlife job, I worked as a research assistant and then a field leader for a couple of professors at UC Santa Cruz who were doing rare plant studies out at Fort Ord and restoration ecology research on landfills. And that was interesting. It was definitely a very redeeming to have a paying job right out of college. And then from there, I just kept, I went on this whole spiral of, or not spiral, but pathway of tons of seasonal work and traveling everywhere, and drove my dad batty, but finally settled down.
So Kelly, this explains two things. One, why you have such a wide breadth of biological knowledge, because Fort Ord has got more rare species than just about anywhere I've ever seen in the world. Yeah. And then your work in radio, why you're such a good communicator.
Called myself that in high school, but thank you. I appreciate hearing that now. Yeah, it was to start off my work in essentially botany, which was what I was the field of study for these research for these topics of research. It was definitely a good foundation for where I ended up going.
Well, hooray for botanist wildlife biologists.
Amen. And Dan, you were saying your first job was on the Lake Almanor district. Is that right?
Well, actually, my first job was as a dishwasher, of which I'm very proud. I began a career in dishwashing at age 14 at the local yacht club on San Francisco Bay in Marin County. And I actually had Social Security credits, from 1968, from when I was 14 years old. But after a year or so of that, I realized that wasn't going to be my future pathway. They told me, if you really work hard, someday you can work your way to be cook. Like, uh-oh. So I went and studied harder in school. I had a couple of seasonal jobs. I didn't have a long stretch of seasonal jobs. I was lucky enough while I was a grad student at Berkeley to get a co-op position with the Forest Service. And so I started at the Lassen National Forest working on the Wildlife Habitat Relationships Program, which was a big thing back then where we were developing models to describe the habitat relationships between animals and various habitats and successional stages. That was my in, and then I ended up going to Almanor Ranger District, where I served as a district biologist for 5 years. And that was fantastic. I mean, it was the best place to work and live, I think, ever. We had Lake Almanor, big waterfowl populations, other water bird colonies, ospreys, bald eagles, and we also had the Ishi country, deer and mill creek, and antelope creek with golden eagles, one of the three pairs of peregrine falcons that were still nesting in the Sierra at that time, lots of golden eagles, and also spring run Chinook salmon, still coming up the deer and mill creeks. So, it was just this incredible diversity of wildlife. And it was a very different time. Eagles were in real trouble. We were working hard to, determine how bad the DDT effects were. I was hiring people to climb trees to collect eggshells to measure them. We were climbing into a peregrine falcon nest to retrieve the eggs, hatch them, bring the hatchlings back and put them back in the nest because they weren't surviving. And things were quite different, but it was really exciting because I was the only one working there in biology doing fish and, everything else. So lots of fun, good background.
And so valuable. That's really delightful for me to hear because I've spent a decent amount of time out there. And my partner's spent 3 field seasons working on California spotted owls and northern goshawks and trapping some peregrine falcons out there. And so to see that many of those wildlife species have, their populations are doing so much better than when you were out there. And I'm sure you had a big role in making that happen.
Well, I'm not sure that's true for spotted owls, but it is, a number of those species have come back tremendously, osprey, bald eagles, peregrines in particular. I did the first spotted owl surveys on the Lassen National Forest. People were asking, why are we doing this? What's this about? Who are these spotted owls? I mean, nobody, it wasn't on people's radar at the time. I remember getting a memo from the regional office asking us to do goshawk questions. And my boss comes in and says, "What the heck is this goosehawk?" You know, like, oh boy, okay. So, you know, we found the first goshawk nests and began monitoring them. So it was really exciting because everything was new. Nothing, almost nothing had been done except on a few of the high profile species, the deer and some of the waterfowl. So.
How exciting to be there at the forefront and how different it is from now where you say the high profile species, the deer, when you're, and people don't care about the owls and the eagles.
I know. Tell me about it. I mean, I can remember when the Western Section meeting, you know, about half the papers were on big game. Now I can't find somebody to chair the big game session because there's so few people working on big game. It's really, you know, things have changed a lot in a lot of ways. We'll get into that later, perhaps.
So Dan, this is an exciting story. It goes from dishwasher to president-elect.
So, yeah, to washed up retired biologist.
So with that, I'm going to move into our questions about what it's like to be president and president-elect, and we're going to give maybe 1 or 2 minutes per question, and I've got questions specifically for you, Kelly, and specifically for Dan, but feel free to interject and tell us what you know about any of these questions. So, Kelly, it's been a year. It's been quite a year. I think anybody can say that, but you were in a particularly high-profile role for leading the section in what might be one of the most difficult periods of its time, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. What was the biggest challenge you faced as president of the Western Section in 2020?
Wow, that's a big question. Well, I think part of it was just how quickly we had to pivot as a section to adapt to our changing circumstances, the changing environment, the changing life around us. I know I certainly came out of our Reading meeting fired up and ready to fly out to Washington, D.C. and lobby, you know, promote Western Section policy hopes and dreams, and that all came to a very fast and abrupt screeching halt and in March. And as a section, you know, we had to rethink how we did workshops and how did we do outreach and how did we do board meetings and how did we do XYZ and how do we keep the momentum of who we are and what we are trying to do in this pandemic. And that was probably the most challenging. I would say that I am so grateful for the entire board because I wasn't doing this alone. I mean, this is all a collective body of work, you know, leading the section. It's, and I'm very grateful for all the support and the ideas and the work that comes from all the different committees and other board members. But that was definitely a challenge, you know, to rethink how we did things. You know, obviously there's been a number of other challenges throughout this year. And I think, you know, I think back to a couple of things, you know, if my ability as president to reach out to members and to let them know, to remind them like, hey, you guys are biologists, you guys are tough as nails. Like we can all do this if we dig deep. You know, I know that so many people's lives were turned upside down, you know, people lost jobs. Parents were struggling to figure out how to do this, you know, abide by stay-at-home orders with young children at home, trying to do school and Zoom. And, you know, just, the, you know, some people couldn't travel to research sites and all that. And, you know, I had to push pause on myself quite a bit to say, gosh, you know, remember that you have the tools within you. You have that snarky sense of humor that got you through really tough field days fired up right now because you need to get through these really tough days. You know how to be resourceful. You know how to be positive. You know how to be resilient. And a lot of that just came from, I can't tell you how many countless days in the field doing the work that I do. And it really inspired me to remind other members in the section of what I'm sure they had within them too.
So would you say that maybe 2020 was like a big jaguar in the road?
It was. You really had to think it and shake the fear out and just charge on down the road again. Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Wow. And sing jingle bells. And here we are.
And here we are. And we thank you so much for that leadership, because, you know, things were tough, and it really made a difference to have somebody calm and collected and willing to steer the ship without adding to the panic, which is so easy for a leader to do.
Yeah, you know, I think that's part of my philosophy of life is just take care of the little piece of land around you. You know, when crisis hits, you take care of your family, you get up and you take care of your neighborhood, you take care of the places you care about. And I think if we all do that every single day, like, the world is beautiful, you know, because we're all doing our part.
Great advice.
And, you know, I think about that with, you know, part of it was, I had this little amazing 10-year-old who was like, let's go out to the creek again and clean it up. You know, and she did that every single week for 8 weeks. And that became our family pattern, picking up 555 pounds of trash from a half mile section of creek that we'd just cleaned up the week before. So it's making the difference every little step at a time. And I think that speaks volumes for what we all collectively do.
So Dan, you came into the board after a long hiatus. Do you have any regrets on the year you decided to rejoin the Western Section Board?
Oh, do you think I would admit it if I did? So I even, come on.
It's been really
great. And I mean, these times are tough, but honestly, much less tough for me than for so many people. You know, I'm retired. I don't have to go to a 40-hour a week job or do a 40-hour or 50-hour a week job from home. You know, my youngest daughter is a senior in high school, and she doesn't need any, she doesn't want any advice or help from me, you know. So it's really, my life hasn't changed personally all that much. I'm kind of a loner. I spend a lot of time in the field. I still do that. But in terms of the section, it's been great to come back. And the things that I've enjoyed are just working with the people, you know, and seeing the diversity of people in terms of ages, sex, you know, everything, and experience, and just getting to act with them. Of course, it would have been better if we were all doing it in person, but we just make it work. And the other thing I have to call out is, you know, my primary responsibility as president-elect is putting helping to put the annual meeting together. And of course, we're going virtual, and that's been challenging. But, and as I've said to our meeting organizer, Candace Renger, I'm probably the worst person to have been elected to chair a virtual conference, you know, because I'm not very adept at a lot of things technological. But thank goodness for the great support we have in our staff here in the Western Section, Candace, Cynthia Perrine, and you, Ivan, for helping us get through all of this. And it actually amazes me how smoothly things are going. I'm sure we're going to see some bumps somewhere along the way during our meeting or in the lead up to it, but things are going very well. And I think we're going to have a really successful meeting and hopefully attract more people, because it's easy to attend. You don't have to drive 300 miles or 800 miles, and you don't have to pay for a hotel. You can just log on and learn something. So that's my, had to make, put a little pitch in there as well, you know?
Right, of course. Yeah, and one of the things I wanted to ask you was, what is it like knowing that you'll be the first person to host the virtual conference?
I think the best word for it is terrifying. you know, I don't know what I'm doing with respect to all of this, and you know, is my Wi-Fi going to work? Is my daughter going to be on her Zoom calls? And my wife is being from home. So I finally concluded, if I go to my second home and isolate myself for a week where I have good Wi-Fi, it'll probably work. But I think it's going to be a real juggling session. But I think we have it under control, and I think we have great talks, we have great sessions, and I think we're gonna make it a fun event and meaningful for people. Minus the thing that I value the most, I have always valued the most of these meetings, which is the camaraderie of getting together and seeing all my friends and acquaintances who I've been, you know, it's the one time a year when you really get to interact with people. So that won't be the same, but we're going to get as close as we can. And that'll be good. And that'll be good enough for now.
Well, I know I, for one, I'm really excited about the results, and I'm thrilled to hear that it sounds like it's going to be a good conference no matter what. So Kelly, would you be willing to tell us, you know, we've heard about some of the struggles over the last year and some of the philosophy you have in overcoming those struggles, but what was a highlight from your presidency?
So my highlight is actually, you know, rooted in a struggle that our country went through with the killing of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests that emerged out of that. I shared with you through the letter, through the statement that our board put together, that, you know, I initially was not quite sure what I should do personally as a president of the Western section. It was absolutely terrifying to put together that statement. I did it with full support of the board, but it was terrifying because I had my name on it, and it was, I tell you, I worked with the board, we hit send, and I went camping because I was so worried about sticking our neck out and making a statement like that. I was really concerned about the pushback, the blowback. But the highlight that emerged from that was just the flood of love letters that we received from members in the Western section. It warmed my heart so much. It brought calm and peace and it reassurance that what we did as a board was the right thing to do. And to not only make a statement, but to take some measurable action as well. Like, you know, the diversity training that's coming up, you know, ways that we're thinking about how we move forward and keep this momentum and keep this focus and keep this energy. It's critical. And that's definitely a highlight. I think one of the most powerful parts of that, one of the most powerful love letters I got was from a gentleman down in Southern California who said he had received, you know, someone had forwarded him the email of our statement. And he's not a member, but he was moved by it. And he is a board member of the Southern California Academy of Sciences. And he said, look, the Western section made this statement. We cannot sit silent. We need to also do something. And so their board, you know, took it upon themselves to follow our model. And that's just one of the many stories that I heard. But, you know, there was, but to me, that spoke volumes, to be able to be willing to stand up as a Western section, as a board, to say this matters and we're not going to stay silent. And it's hard for me to put that into words, but it was definitely a highlight. It let me know we were on the right side of history.
Well, that's very relieving to know that it came out as a positive outcome. As I remember those emails that the board sent before you sent the letter and how it felt like we were in a situation room almost, trying to figure out, are we going to tackle this? What is the best way to tackle this? You know, we've heard it from your point of view, Kelly, and very grateful that you were able to get something, you know, wonderful out of the result. Dan, how did you feel during that time?
Well, I was pretty deeply affected by the whole situation, as I think most people were. And I thought we acted very quickly and appropriately. I was very driven to make sure that we not only made the statement, but then that we stay committed to actually contributing, to solutions and doing actual things that will contribute to bettering the situation with respect to diversity in our section. So I think we have some, they're small steps, but they're exciting steps that we've taken. And I'm grateful to Kelly and to the board for staying strong. You know, we had some detractors, and it's easy to worry about the detractors, but at some point you just say, people that don't share fundamental values that most of us hold, who's not going to worry about them? They can go somewhere else and find another group that shares their values, but we're not obligated to, purge out everybody's values in the world. There are things that are right and there are things that are wrong, and we took the right path.
So you say the focus of your presidency is on the members, but there may be some people that you think are welcome to leave the section based on their response to Kelly's letter. Would you be willing to elaborate a little on that?
Well, yeah, that's probably a bit of a misstatement, because I believe the people that objected the most, Kelly can verify this, I think, were not members.
They were not members.
People who somehow, got onto the thread and began complaining, and we started listening, but then realized, wait a minute, these people aren't really members, they're trolls. So I don't really think it's an issue within the section. I mean, I've not had anyone contact me and express any objection whatsoever about the position that we took, that we're Western section members.
I would say that, so much about this is about how do we lead and model. It's not about shoving an agenda down people's throats. It's about how do we lead and model diversity and inclusion and equity in our board, and, roll out, from everything from our diversity committee to the diversity award to letting our members know, like, this is important. And I think that the more people see that, the more it's like, oh yeah, that is important. It becomes, even if you're kind of sitting on the sidelines, like, I don't understand what the hoopla is about. Seeing the board take steps in a direction and roll out programs and workshops and trainings and awards helps kind of raise that level of awareness and comfort of like, okay, I'm not getting left behind. This is about a bigger story than me, and I'm going to stay on board. That is my hope of what we can do as a board with those folks who may be sitting on the sidelines a little bit questioning.
Simon, you asked me about an example of an action, and one that is modest but I think really interesting and important is this year, for the first time in our scientific sessions at the Western Section meeting, we're having a session entitled Traditional Ecological Knowledge, and we're bringing in Native American perspectives into wildlife management, which I'm quite sure we've never had a session like this before. I'm sure we've had a few Native American members, but this is really a different thing about tapping into a whole knowledge base on behalf of wildlife and wildlife management that we haven't accessed before. And so, it's a start. I think we just have three papers. But really opening up something different that improves our inclusion and our diversity. So I'm really excited about that. It's just a simple, but important step.
So maybe building off of that statement, Dan, what would you say is the most important thing you hope to accomplish over the next year as president?
Well, you know what? That's actually a tough question for me. I'm still getting to know the section again. I mean, obviously, I've been around for a long time, but the inner workings of the section are still emerging for me. The simplest answer, I think, is serving our members. That's really what a professional society is about, to serve the membership and to simply maintaining what we've been doing in terms of professional education and development, providing camaraderie. Hear that from me a lot because I think it's really important. Those basic things that we've been doing continue to be important. But I hope that we will expand and particularly expand the diversity of our membership. I'd like to see us continue. Kelly has done a fantastic job in conservation. I'd like to see us continue to develop a stronger voice in conservation matters. It's a big challenge because we are all so busy in our own little worlds that it's difficult. But I would really like to see that, and I'd like to see increased participation by our members and membership, broadening the membership and getting them more involved to serve them and to serve conservation and our mission.
Thank you. So, Kelly, do you have any advice for the incoming president as he faces 2021?
Well, lean on the board. There is a wealth of experience, talent, expertise, and knowledge in and among all the board members too. And you don't have to drive the ship alone. There's a lot of help out there. And be bold. It's okay to, you're elected as president to lead with a vision and to shape the section as you see. And I think that's one thing I learned is you can think outside the box a little bit and go big or go home. and I think it's good to think that way, try out new ideas. I think one of the things that's so interesting about this time we live in is that I've never lived through a pandemic, So this means that we get to, think about the way we do things differently and try new things. And why not? What do you have to lose? So if you have an idea, toss it out there and let's run with it as a board.
Thank you.
That's great advice. Well, thank you, Dan and Kelly, for joining us. I know that you had to turn off your radiator, Kelly, so that there wasn't enough noise. So our president is sitting there in the cold, and Dan has literally got his mittens on because he's just come in from the field, and in an attempt not to wake his daughter, is doing the interview outside. So this is the dedication of the president and president-elect for the Western Section members. So thank you for that. And thank you for the work you've done over the last year. And we are very much looking forward to the work coming up in the future.
Thank you so much for the conversation, Ivan.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And good to see everybody here.
Thank you for tuning in to Western Section Podcasts.
It has been a pleasure meeting with this show's guests, Kelly Holland and Dan Arola,
President and President-elect. We'd like to thank our producer, Brandon Noonan.
We'd like to thank our Oversight Committee, our Program Director, Cynthia Perrine, and Project Manager, Candace Renger.
And our Podcast Committee, Angela Amlin, Elizabeth Meisman,
and Ivan Parr. To all our members, please stay safe and healthy,
and be part of something wilder.